From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the 1960s, we didn't know much about where facial expressions fit in human history. Some argued expressions were distinctive to certain cultures, that they varied, like customs and dress. But the psychologist Paul Ekman believed Darwin had it right, that expressions were innate and universal, that no matter where you were, you responded to the basic emotions like fear and anger in the same ways. Ekman's research vindicated Darwin's theory, and it set him on a career of exploring the nature of expressions and emotions. Ekman's latest book is a dialogue with the Dalai Lama that explores the central questions about emotional experience. Paul Ekman will be in Utah this weekend. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his conversations with the Dalai Lama and what he learned about emotional awareness. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Many of you know the psychologist Paul Ekman as the man who can tell if a person is lying by detecting subtle facial expressions that give them away. He's the world's expert on expressions, and he's the inspiration for the television series starring Timothy Roth called Lie to Me. But this is more than a parlor trick or a law enforcement tool. Ekman's career is based on understanding the nature of emotions as much as the tics and twitches they provoke. His most recent book is an intriguing dialogue with the Dalai Lama about the essence of emotional experience and the questions that come along with it. Along the way, they get at the nature of happiness and compassion and hate. Ekman will be in Utah this weekend, and today on the program, he's joining us to talk about his relationship with the Dalai Lama and what he learned about emotional awareness. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Paul Ekman is a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of California's Medical School in San Francisco. Among his books are Telling Lies and Emotions Revealed. We should also mention that Ekman's work, as I said, inspired the television series Lie to Me. He's a consultant on that series, and he's going to be in Utah this weekend, a guest of the Sundance Resort there, and we'll tell you more about that as we go along. Today on the program, he's joining us from the San Francisco airport before catching his flight this way. And Paul Ekman, welcome to the program. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, before we get to the dialogue with the Dalai Lama, I wanted to ask, first about your origins of your career in this field. Now, if I get it right, it happened something like 40 years ago. You were discussing with a group of young psychiatrists a pretty basic question. How can you tell if a patient is telling the truth? Is that where it sort of started in some way?
Yes, actually it was with suicidal patients who said that they were feeling much better, no longer intending to take their life, and they wanted a pass for a day or the weekend to spend with their family. And most of them are telling the truth, but occasionally someone is simply trying to get free of the hospital supervision and take their life rather quickly. And so they asked me, since at that point I was already studying gesture and expression, whether there was any way to tell. It took me about 25 years to come up with some answers.
Right. Was there one moment when you realized, hey, I think I can tell that there's a micro expression there that's revealing something?
Yes, actually it was in the first few hours. After I took on this task, I had looked at a film of an interview with a patient who I had been told afterwards had been successfully deceiving the therapist. And at real time, the patient looked very cheerful. Then I went through it in slowed motion and saw the first micro-expression I'd ever seen. Just one or two frames, about little more than a 24th of a second, and but severe anguish. And looking through the rest of the film, I saw a few more of these expressions, and that got me started on that part of it. But actually, to achieve any real accuracy, although the face is the single most important source, it's necessary, it's not sufficient. You really need to consider the gestures, the posture, the gaze, the sound of the voice, and the speech itself.
I guess that it's important to say along that line that while you may be able to tell if someone is being deceptive, there's a deeper context to all of that. As you've said before, no expression of emotion reveals exactly what's triggering it, and that's just as important, I guess.
That's true. And in with this Lie to Me series, I not only review critically each script and give them feedback, which they most of the time take, but I write a critical evaluation of each program that appears on the FoxTV.com website called The Truth About Lie to Me, Separating the Science from the Fiction. Mm-hmm. And in the first show, not to give away too much, that will premiere on the 28th of this month, Tim Roth, Dr. Lightman, says, I can tell when someone's lying, but I can't tell what motivated the lie. Mm. And I distinguished some 8 different motives for lying, and he got that right. I'm very pleased to see it. In fact, I think I may have succeeded in convincing the writers and producers of this show that there should be an episode in which Tim Roth gets it wrong.
Yeah.
That is, he falsely accuses someone of lying who's actually being truthful, because that does happen. This isn't perfect. You know, we can do a lot better than chance, but it's not always correct, and it has to be verified if the consequences are going to be serious by other means.
How do you describe the purpose of your work? I mean, beyond understanding the science of emotions, because you've talked about the importance of improving emotional understanding and evaluating truthfulness, is how you put it.
Well, that's true, and you know the work on truthfulness is really, although it occupies most of my time post 9/11, more fundamental part of my work was on the nature of emotion itself, and since getting to know the Dalai Lama, on the nature of compassion. I'm going to be meeting with him once again at the end of this month to talk with him about the new ideas I've developed since our dialogue, since the book. You know, you don't stop thinking about these matters, particularly when you've talked for so long with someone as provocative as he is. And I think the issue of the cultivation of compassion on a global level is one of the critical problems of our time, and I hope I can make some contribution towards our understanding of that.
Mm. I want to get to the conversations you had with the Dalai Lama here in a moment, but first let me understand your relationship with Darwin, because there used to be, I mentioned this at the beginning of the program, that it used to be believed that facial expressions were, you know, kind of distinctive to particular cultures. But you had this hunch that these things were actually, you know...
Actually, I did think that Margaret Mead was the one who said it was all a cultural language. You know, I was a student of my times, and
right.
I thought, like everyone else, Mead was right and Darwin was wrong. I was 19th century kind of biological thinking, and, you know, that our expressions are just another kind of language. That's why it was even called body language, and we know that languages differ from one place to another. So my research on this, there wasn't really any conclusive evidence one way or the other, and when I set out to get it, I set out to support the culture view, and I got just the opposite in my findings. So I'm one of those scientists whose data changed his mind.
You traveled to different cultures. Papua New Guinea was one of those places. And do you remember, I won't ask you if there was a eureka moment or an epiphanal moment, but when did you start to realize that these expressions are the same everywhere in the world?
Well, fairly early, I knew that the critical case would be of people who had no contact with the outside world. Otherwise, if they showed the same expressions, you could say it was, you know, seeing John Wayne and Charlie Chaplin that produced common expressions across cultures, not anything unique to our biology. And so I started searching for a visually isolated culture. And I learned about a scientist at NIH who had been studying such a culture in New Guinea, in the highlands of New Guinea, and filming them. Although his interests were in brain disorder, he also realized how important it was to document such a culture. So he lent me all of his film, over 100,000 feet of film, and I started going through it, and I never saw an expression I hadn't seen before. There was nothing new. And when there was enough of the social context evident where I could verify whether I was making the correct judgment, I always was, even though I didn't know these people, didn't know anything about them. So it was then clear to me that Darwin was right and Mead was wrong, and the issue was, how are they going to get evidence? Just looking at films isn't really acceptable scientific evidence in most circles. And I made two trips to these very same people in 1967 and 68. And in the second trip, I got very good, strong evidence for the six emotions I was looking at being really the same. It doesn't matter what your culture or language is. These people were Stone Age. I mean, most of them had never seen an outsider. When I lit a match, I was doing something miraculous they'd never seen before.
Do you think anyone can be taught to spot tells, maybe that's not the right word, but these expressions?
Yes, I call them leakage of concealed emotion.
Right.
And actually, on my website, paulekman.com, I've put a tool that teaches you in really under an hour how to recognize these micro-expressions. And I was really surprised that it's so easy to learn. But you can't learn it without using this tool. You need the kind of practice and feedback it gives you. Originally, I thought I was going to just restrict its use to law enforcement, but then doctors and nurses wanted it, and people in emergency rooms and school guards. And so now anybody can get access to it. And I used to make it impossible for you to get to it if you were from a non-democracy, but my friends in the government said, all you're doing is blocking the citizens because the governments and non-democracies will always find a workaround.
Right.
So it's available and is learned online by people all over the world who want to spot concealed emotions. But there's one drawback I always warn people about. You can't unlearn it. So you may not always like what you see. and yet once you've learned this, you're going to see the emotions that people are trying to conceal from you and your spouse and your kids and your friends and your work associates. It can be very useful, but it can be very upsetting as well.
That could be something of a burden for some people, don't you think?
It could be. So that's why I say, make sure you really want to know those hidden messages. There's no question in counterterrorism and law enforcement, in the health professions, you need to, for both innocent and malevolent reasons. People are sometimes concealing their feelings, and it can be useful, particularly in the health professions, but also in counterterrorism, to be able to know what emotion someone is feeling and doesn't want you to know. But, you know, when you get home at night and talk to your spouse, you're going to see those concealed emotions, too, if they're there.
Is it true that you gave up telling at least the big lies when your daughter was born?
Yes, I thought it would be an interesting mental exercise to see whether I could, since I believed at that time, on the basis of some research I'd done on children, that children learn about truth and lying and its advantages and disadvantages from simply seeing what their parents do. So I thought I would try to provide a model to my daughter of someone who never tells a serious lie, that is, a lie where the consequences could be grave and the person who's the target would be very unhappy if they found out that they had been deceived. And it took a lot of work at first because, you know, lying, one of the motives that for why people lie is to get out of awkward social situations. And if you don't use the lie and tell the truth, you don't want to be offensive. You'd want to be impolite. You'd want to say, well, the last time I had dinner at your house was really boring, so I don't want to accept your invitation. So So you have to find out a way to remain polite and yet not engage in a lie. This just happened to me 2 days ago. A friend of mine who works at the San Francisco Opera had called the day before and said, I have two tickets for a dress rehearsal tomorrow night. Do you and your wife want to use them? And I said, yes. But that night, it was one of the few times I really had a bad night's sleep, and the next morning I was exhausted. And I knew if I went to the opera, I was just going to sit there and fall asleep. And so first, I had the natural thought, even after all this time, I would say to him, gee, I've woken up with a bit of a flu. And then I thought, well, why can't I just tell him the truth? Why should I have to make up something false? Mm. And now, this is a trivial lie, but still, lying is a slippery slope. If you really don't want to fall into the trap of telling a lot of lies, then you have to take every opportunity and find a way. So I simply called him and said, I really wish I could go, but I couldn't sleep last night, so you should try to give that ticket to someone else. My wife will still go, but it doesn't make sense for me. I need to go home and take a nap at that time.
Right. Paul Ekman is with us. He's going to be at the Sundance Resort on Saturday at noon as part of the Tree Room Author Series. He's going to be discussing his book, Emotional Awareness, Overcoming the Obstacles to Psychological Balance and Compassion. It was a conversation between the Dalai Lama and Paul Ekman, and we're going to talk about that book when we get back from a break. For tickets and information, by the way, to the Sundance Series, call 801-223-4242. Or just visit our website at KUER.org/Radio West. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the psychologist Paul Ekman is with us. Ekman has spent his career exploring human emotion and their effect on our behavior. He's mapped the expressions of the face, and he can tell you pretty much when you're lying. A few years ago, Ekman began a series of conversations with the Dalai Lama. He was trying to get at some really essential questions like, what are the sources of hate or compassion? Paul Ekman is coming to Utah. He's going to be here as part of the Sundance Tree Room Author Series, and he's joining us to talk about the book that came from that conversation called Emotional Awareness. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. Paul Ekman, I wanted to ask you about what got you started on this dialogue with the Dalai Lama. It seems like it stretched back to this conference you attended in Vancouver in 2004. This is was called the Opening of the Heart Conference, and I guess all these questions started to sort of bubble to the surface for you.
Well, they did then, but it goes back even earlier. In the year 2000, my daughter Eve had. When she was just a high school junior, spent 6 weeks in Nepal with a group of kids, and after trekking for 4 weeks, she spent 2 weeks living with a Tibetan refugee family. And she got very passionate about the cause of the Tibetans. And I had no interest in either Tibet, Buddhism or the Dalai Lama, but I knew that if you as a scientist got invited to meet with him, you got to bring a silent observer. And I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful for my daughter? So I put my name in the ring and I got invited. In 2000, I spent 5 days. There were four other scientists, and my daughter was there as an observer the whole time. And the Dalai Lama and I just had an amazing, to me, inexplicable connection. You know, one of these deja vu experiences. And he's very amused by the fact that he can explain it because he knows that we were in a previous incarnation, related, perhaps brothers. Mm. I can't explain it from a Western point of view, but we all have this experience where we meet someone, we feel we've known them all our lives. We feel like enormous closeness to them. And that's what happened to the two of us. And so when there was another opportunity to hear him talk, actually my daughter and I together went to Vancouver, And I heard him talk about emotion,
yeah,
which is what I had been talking to him about a few years earlier. And he had some of it right, but he had some of it wrong.
Hmm.
And I thought, gee, we really need to explore this further. It took about a year to get it into his schedule, but then between 2004 and 2007, we spent almost 40 hours in one-on-one conversation,
hmm,
more time than I've ever spent with anyone,
wow,
talking about a single topic or set of topics. It was enormous fun. He's a very interesting guy, charming, enormously bright, and he comes from such a different tradition that everything I take for granted, he doesn't. And, of course, everything he takes for granted, I don't. So we had a marvelous time, and it charted some new territory, and both of us changed our views on certain issues and developed some new ideas. And, of course, it hasn't stopped. That's why I'll be meeting with him on the 28th of this month in Vancouver once again.
How do you describe Paul Ekman, I guess if you can distill it, if that's even possible, what it is you're getting at with these conversations, what you wanted to learn or explore in essence?
Well, a number of things. One was a better understanding of why it is so difficult for us to exercise choice about when we become emotional, what we become emotional about, and how we behave when we are emotional.
Hmm.
Those are enormously, I think, important issues to all of us, not just for ourselves, but for those we deal with in an intimate way. And yet, these are perplexing issues. I think we've made some real progress in exposing what those issues are and some of the reasons why these difficulties occur and some steps towards what you can do to try to increase your choice. We call the book Emotional Awareness because awareness is the critical issue. How do we bring awareness? Without awareness, there is no choice.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we bring awareness right to the beginning? You know, when I finished my last year of training in 1957, I was then training to be a psychotherapist, which I ended up never being. But in any case, at that time, I thought that's what I was on the road to. And my supervisor said to me, if you can increase the gap between impulse and action, you'll have done an enormous favor for your patients. What he didn't say is that in the West, we don't know much about how to do that.
Yeah.
Now, the Buddhists use exactly the same conceptual framework, that is, recognizing the spark before the flame. But they have some mental exercises, which I think are quite useful in trying to increase that gap so that you're aware of the impulse. It's not easy. It takes practice. Unlike learning to read micro-expressions or learning to read to ride a bicycle, you know, you can learn to ride a bicycle, most people can learn in under an hour, and once you've learned it, you're not going to ever unlearn it. You don't need to ride a bicycle every day or every week or every year. In fact, if you haven't ridden a bicycle for 5 years, you can get right back on and ride it. That's not so with bringing awareness to bear on emotional impulses. That takes a daily practice to maintain. Because in my view, and in the Dalai Lama's view also, though he wouldn't have originally put it in these terms, we did not evolve. Our brains evolved for dealing without thought with saber-toothed tigers that jumped out of nowhere. Their current equivalent is the car that comes veering at us at 60 miles an hour. Those are the saber-toothed tigers we deal with today. But if you had to think about what to do, if you couldn't respond automatically to either the tiger or to that near-miss car that's coming at you, you wouldn't survive. But how? That's not what is occupying most of us. Most of the time, we want to be able to consider, is this really a situation I want to get emotional about? Is it worth it? Mm. And if so, how can I best act that will be of benefit to me and the person I'm involved with at this moment? Not an easy task.
No. How did you deal with the fact that this was, to some, a spiritual leader, a religious leader? I mean, there's this little footnote in the book where that explains that while the Dalai Lama is called His Holiness, you rarely used that in conversations because you don't actually see him as a holy person, extraordinary person, but not a holy person.
Well, see, I don't see anyone as holy.
Right.
And I don't mean by saying that to either disrespect Buddhists or people who believe in any religion.
Yeah.
I don't, and if they do, that's fine with me. I don't see any point in challenging those who have religious belief. The Dalai Lama said, and I think it's in the book, 90% of what we talked about is there, but I did excise about 10%, so I can't always be certain. But he said, you know, I don't know whether reincarnation is true.
Yeah.
How would I know? But it's what I believe. Well, I don't believe in that, and I think there are some extraordinarily good people, and he's one of them, who are of wonderful benefit to the world. But I do not attribute that to holiness.
Yeah.
Now, Buddhism, as Darwin said in some unpublished work, Buddhism is a religion without a God, which from a Western point of view is almost incomprehensible. Many people view Buddhism as more a philosophy than a religion. But in any case, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a follower of any particular spiritual practice.
What do you make of there was this interesting moment in the book where you realized that the philosophies of Tibetan Buddhism and the ideas about emotion that that Darwin expressed were kind of identical.
Yes. Do you know, I'm working on an article now. It's called, Was Darwin a Buddhist? Just to give you a hint of what's in that article.
Yeah.
In one of Darwin's last books, The Descent of Man, there are two chapters that deal primarily with social ethical issues. And the fundamental ideas he expressed about the highest moral virtue is identical to Buddhism. His treatment of compassion, which he calls sympathy, doesn't use the word compassion, but he uses it for exactly the same concept. Both the origin of compassion and the motivation behind it are identical to the Buddhist view. Now, you could say this is a coincidence of great minds coming to the same conclusion independently, but I've been able, through historical research, to show, and that's what's in this article, that there were six independent pathways by which Darwin learned about Buddhism, and in some of his unpublished writing, he doesn't acknowledge getting the ideas from them, but he shows and uses some Buddhist terms that like this quote I gave you, that it's a religion without a God.
Yeah.
So I do believe that that was an influence on this part of his work. Yeah. That doesn't mean he didn't add to it, and he did add some ideas about the benefits of a sympathetic or compassionate attitude towards one's fellow human beings. But it's, you know, it is quite Buddhist. But, you know, there are some fundamental teachings that all the religions share in common. Christianity, you could say, has some resemblance in some of Jesus' teachings to Buddhist belief. Now, there are fundamental differences as well between the different major religions.
Mm. I wonder... It's hard to, not hard, but there are certain things that don't translate on the printed page in terms of your relationship. And I wondered, if you would talk about the nature of that. You call it in the book this kind of intense friendship. So there must have been, I think you said there was a lot of loud laughter. And
there was. We were, you know, I've never had so much fun.
Huh.
And, you know, my wife likes to go to comedy clubs. I don't. I just to go someplace just for the purpose of being amused just has never appealed to me. Hmm. But with the Dalai Lama, he's having such a good time, and he's a jokester. And the jokes always have a serious issue embedded with them. And we just had a lot of fun. And when you're breaking new ground, it's so exciting. And it's, you know, I've produced a CD, I think is on my website, called Minding Emotion, in which you can hear an hour of our back-and-forth dialogue, because it's very, very lively. And there's quite a lot of laughing and joking and seeing some of the humorous implications of what are really very serious issues and matters. Hatred and violence are, you know, enormously serious matters. Yet, talking with him, we just, as I anticipate it will be again, very enjoyable experience.
Mm. I was interested in whether or not you found yourself reading the Dalai Lama's expressions, you know, his demeanor, and I'm wondering if he revealed certain things. Did you ever sense that he was, you know, evading a point or a question, and did you feel comfortable enough to sort of call him on it?
Yes and no. I think he is a man without any guile whatsoever.
Wow.
And that's rather remarkable. I have to struggle. You know, I was brought up by a Western family, and I was, you know, don't be impolite to your aunt, or don't get angry at your father. You know, we're all brought up to conceal some of our feelings, particularly towards authority figures. So, but he wasn't brought up that way. And he is, as a world political leader, which he is both a spiritual figure, but he's also the head of state of a country in exile. But his lack of guile, he wrote an autobiography called Freedom in Exile, and a good part of it is how he was totally taken in by Mao. He really believed they were going to preserve Tibetan culture, which was a quite explicit and deliberate lie, and exactly the opposite of what's happened. So I never saw any microexpressions from him because he's not concealing any of his feelings.
Mm.
Quite remarkable to think that there are people like that, but there are. On the other hand, there's certain issues he won't talk about, and which he regards as mysteries. Now this sounds very non-Western, and it is. Actually, it's not non-Western. It's non-20th or 21st century. There are certain people who, when you're in their presence, and he's one of them, you just have a sense of goodness. Now, goodness is this sort of 19th or 18th century word, and yet throughout human history there have been people who've been described in this way, and you just enjoy being with them because you can just get this good feeling. Now, what is that? We don't understand it from a Western point of view.
Yeah.
And he would not talk about it. He said, it's a mystery. Why can't you accept mysteries? I can't. Now, I can accept that there are things there's a lot I don't understand, but I don't view it as fundamentally not susceptible to understanding. When I finished my graduate training 50 years ago, frightening to think it was that long ago. There were a lot of things we didn't understand that we understand now.
Yeah.
And so I believe the frontiers of knowledge are not frozen. They are advancing. And that, for example, 50 years from now, people will think how foolish he couldn't understand goodness. Well, goodness is a result of X, Y, and Z. Right now we don't, and he did not want to explore that at all. That was off limits.
Paul Ekman is with us. Among his books are Emotions Revealed and Emotional Awareness, a conversation between the Dalai Lama and Paul Ekman. He's going to be talking about that at the Sundance Resort on this weekend. It's part of the Sundance Tree Room Author Series, and you can get information about that, tickets and information, by calling 801-223-4242. Or you can just go to our website at KUER.org/Radio West, and I should mention that there is a link there from our website to Paul Ekman's website. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the acclaimed psychologist Paul Ekman. He's coming to Utah this weekend here as part of the Sundance Resort Tree Room Author Series. We'll tell you more about that as we go along. In the meantime, you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's an email from Phyllis, who sends this from Salt Lake City. She writes, "I recently suffered an emotional breakdown that lasted for 3 months while I continued to work. There were times," she writes, "that it must have been obvious that I was suffering, and those around me were oblivious to me. I wondered if people couldn't see it, or maybe they didn't want to see it." Paul Ekman, did you get any insights about that kind of thing, whether we sort of look away?
Well, when we see the suffering of another, if we pay attention, for most of us, that will cause a resonant reaction in which we'll feel some of that suffering ourselves. And that in Darwin and in both and the Buddhist view should motivate us to relieve that suffering. Now that's perfectly natural, and I think that everyone experiences it with their children. But with strangers, only some of us feel that. Only some of us, when we heard about the tsunami, were motivated to give money to try to do something to help these people around the and who lived in a totally different part of the world. And when you see someone suffering who's a total stranger, it's a question, do you want to take that on? Is it your responsibility? Do you have that responsibility towards all human beings? Well, people differ in that regard. I do believe that the planet is only going to survive if we get a more global sense of responsibility for the welfare of all people, not just our families, not just our neighbors, not just Americans.
The Dalai Lama seemed to share that sentiment, didn't he?
Yes, he shares it completely. He takes it to he takes it to all sentient beings.
Yeah.
As did Darwin. Darwin said that was the highest moral virtue. But there's one exception I've seen the Dalai Lama make. Although he will carefully remove a fly from a room without injuring the fly, he will kill mosquitoes. I share his attitude towards mosquitoes.
You know, I was really interested in the exchange that you had with the Dalai Lama about, I guess it was the nature of happiness, how you can help make people happy without the material trappings and the wealth. Talk about that conversation. That was interesting.
Well, you know, I don't really remember exactly what we said about it, other than there's just no question that we all seek to be happy. But we use that term to cover everything from amusement to relief to just an overall feeling of well-being or contentment with how our life is going, to excitement. I mean, it covers so many. I mean, in some sense, when someone says, I'm a happy person, we don't really know what they're talking about. All we know is it's on the positive side, but we don't know what. Is it their overall attitude about how their life is going? Is it a moment of excitement or ecstasy or amusement? It covers many things, and yet there's just no question that we all seek to maximize these various kinds and very different types of enjoyable experiences.
The conversation about when emotions are destructive, You say in the book that you kind of reject the value of distinguishing between positive and negative emotions, but the Dalai Lama didn't seem to be going along with you on that point.
Well, I actually think he did. I think in the end he changed his position to and like the one I suggested. I'm going to find out when I see him again in a few weeks whether that has slipped or whether he still accepts the idea that every emotion can be enacted in either a constructive or destructive way. Anger can be a force for social justice. Anger can be a signal that I've got a problem I need to deal with. Hopefully when I'm no longer feeling angry, but it's an important signal of difficulty and an important motive to get us to do something about the obstacles that we're facing. And of course, amusement can be used to ridicule people, to hurt other people, and to enjoy their embarrassment and humiliation. So that's why I believe this simple distinction, distinction is how is a particular emotion being enacted. And the criteria that I suggested, which he really liked, is it's constructive if the outcome is to further collaboration with that person. And because basically we are social beings and we need to cooperate with others in order to achieve any happiness ourselves.
There was this exchange where the Dalai Lama, he seems to have this really quick wit, and you were having this conversation and he said, look, just because it's a part of us, death doesn't mean it's just because it's part of us doesn't necessarily mean it's good. And he talks about death. He says we all die, but nobody really wants to die.
Well, that's, of course, one of the things I disagree with him about. My 93-year-old mother-in-law just died a few months ago, and as best I could tell, she welcomed death. Nothing was working anymore. Mm-hmm. She didn't always recognize her own daughter. She couldn't walk. All of her joints were too painful. She had trouble eating. Everything had worn out. That's one of our remaining disagreements, is do we all fear death, and do we always want to postpone death, or is a life fully led and a life that doesn't involve premature or very painful death, is that always unwelcome? Mm-hmm. Who thinks it is? I don't think so.
Did you find any insights about, you talked a lot about hate and compassion, the cultural and even the evolutionary sources of hate and compassion. So I'm guessing you have your perspective about, okay, in terms of evolution, this is the nature of compassion. This is the nature of hate. What could the Dalai Lama give you that would provide perspective about that from the Buddhist perspective, from his perspective?
Well, from his perspective, hatred is a poison. Yeah. And I emphasized in an earlier book, Emotions Revealed, that hatred can actually be helpful to you, and it can actually help you deal with some terrible events. We both modified our view. I've come to see that although hatred can be useful on the short term, that the maintenance of hatred can be corrosive, and usually is, and begins to distort your emotional reactions to the world and move anger up higher in your life than it might otherwise be. And the change that he made was to see that there can be some short-term benefits of hatred, even though in the long term, it is best regarded as poisonous to our nature.
Did you the sense of empathy that people feel? Did you get a sense that how do you explain that in an evolutionary way? And how did that square with what the Dalai Lama saw as empathy? He thinks that's a very important aspect of human nature.
Well, empathy is a word that I'm in, actually, the talk I'm going to be giving at Sundance, and then in what I'm going to be talking with the Dalai Lama about at the end of the month. I'm trying to deconstruct or take apart into its separate components so that we can examine and better understand them. And just to give you the beginnings of that, one element is to recognize how another person feels.
Yeah.
Without that, you can't have any compassion. But a torturer has to recognize how the other person feels also. So just recognizing doesn't mean you're going to do anything to relieve their suffering. So the next step is what I mentioned earlier in the program, resonance.
Right.
And that is when I actually feel in my body what you're feeling in response to seeing, whether you're feeling joy and that makes me joyful, or you're feeling angry and I get angry and join you in that anger at whoever you're angry at. But resonance is necessary for the development of compassion, but it isn't doing anything. It's just resonating. So then the next step is familial compassion. And that, from the Buddhist point of view, and I think there's really good evidence for it from a Western scientific point of view, that's a given by nature. And actually, I regard familial compassion as an emotion, just like anger or fear. It's unusual in that we can be angry at anybody, not just members of our family, but familial compassion is restricted, really, to members of your family, primarily your offspring. Now, beyond that, there's a range of other, from heroic compassion, where you put your life at risk, to sentient compassion about all living beings, to global compassion for all human beings, but worldwide. So there are many different forms of this that I'm trying to elucidate. And then, of course, you get questions. You know, if you remember this incident a few years back, it got a lot of press attention, where someone had fallen into the subway, and a subway was approaching, and this total stranger jumped in, put his own life at risk, and pulled the other person to safety and got out himself. That's heroic compassion. That's not just relieving someone else's suffering or preventing it, but at serious risk to yourself. Now, most of us don't know whether we have that, because we've never been in that situation. All the other people who are standing on that subway platform, they know they don't have it. So what's the origin of this? Where does it come from? I mean, I would still, I think to this day, show heroic compassion towards members of my immediate family, but would I do that for a total stranger, put my life at risk? And why is it there in some people?
Yeah.
Is it socially learned? Is it, you know, we don't say, why can't everyone play golf as well as Tiger Woods? Is it like that? Is it a gift that only a few people have, a few admirable people? Or is it something that everyone could develop? So once you start making these distinctions, a lot of questions arise, and these are questions I'll be talking with the Dalai Lama about, to see whether he can add any ideas or whether the two of us will spark new ideas that neither of us thought of before.
Yeah. You know, I have to say the most personal part of the book is when you talk about anger. You to reveal your own struggles with anger.
Yes.
Times in your life when you were trying to deal with the problems of anger, but nothing seemed to work. And then you referred to this experience earlier in the program. In the year 2000, you met the Dalai Lama in India, and that seemed to transform you in some way.
Yes, and I still can't explain it. Everyone who knows me saw the consequence of it, and those who lived intimately with me were very happy about the consequence. But it's totally incomprehensible. How did it occur? Why did it occur? My psychoanalyst friends have their explanation, which I don't think is worth much, but I can't offer an explanation, and I couldn't get him to talk about it at all.
Yeah.
It's a mystery from his point of view. I don't think it is a mystery in the sense that we'll never be able to understand how some people in some circumstances have transformative experiences that change their lives. I'm not the only person who's had such an experience. For some people have this in a religious context. Some people have it in a secular context. It was totally unexpected for me. I'm glad it happened. And if I was 50 years younger, I'd spend my next 50 years trying to figure out and try to see how I could do science about it. I made a first beginning by interviewing others who had had the same experience and finding a few things they had in common. But it's only a first step, and it really is, it's uncharted.
Mm.
Now, that makes it really attractive. I mean, why go into an area that is mostly charted? Why not spend your life doing the basic charting yourself? That's, I think, what appeals to most maverick scientists.
Mm. Paul Ekman. He's going to be at the Sundance Resort on Saturday at noon as part of the Tree Room Author Series. He's going to be discussing his book, Emotional Awareness, Overcoming the Obstacles to Psychological Balance and Compassion. For tickets and information, call 801-223-4242 or just visit our website at kuer.org/radiowest. There's a link there, by the way, to Paul Ekman's website. And Paul Ekman, thanks very much for the time.
Well, thank you for having enough time to actually talk about things.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Brendan Morrissey. The show, directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.